Support for Here and Now comes from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy. Clients are matched with one of 25,000 therapists and can communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. British police arrested the radical Muslim cleric Abu Hamza al-Masri at his home early today after the United States asked for his extradition. U.S. Attorney General John Ashcroft today announced an 11-count indictment against Abu Hamza. Charges include trying to establish a terrorist training camp in Oregon and a hostage-taking incident in Yemen.
We are actively seeking Hamza's extradition from Great Britain to face justice in our courts on these serious charges. The maximum sentence for hostage taking, the charges directed toward Hamza, is death penalty or life imprisonment. Hamza also faces a maximum sentence of up to 100 years in prison on the additional charges contained in the indictment.
Attorney General John Ashcroft speaking today. Well, joining us on the line from London is WBUR's Michael Goldfarb. Michael, I feel that this cleric has been in the news in the past, but remind us, who is he?
Well, Abu Hamza was characterized today at that press conference with John Ashcroft by the New York City Police Commissioner Ray Kelly as a freelance consultant to terrorism. Here in Britain, he is the most notorious of a handful of radical Islamist preachers who have been connected up with international jihad. He's become notorious because he lost his right hand and his left eye in Afghanistan when he was a mujahideen, and he's kind of like a Willie Horton figure. He put his picture on the front page of the tabloids and scare everybody with it. But at the Finsbury Park Mosque, where he was the preacher, among the people who attended that mosque were Richard Reed, the shoe bomber, and Zacharias Moussaoui also attended that mosque. In 2002, he was thrown out of the mosque by the Charities Commission, and now leads prayers on Fridays outside the mosque, which is closed, and still manages to draw acolytes. And he also ran a jihad website, which all of which paints a picture of a guy who was at the center of jihadi activities here in Britain.
You mentioned his looks. I think you've mentioned that he's been nicknamed Captain Hook by the tabloids because of his looks. But why is the U.S. going after him? You know, why haven't British authorities arrested him?
Well, that's a very good question, Robin, and I think more reporting has to be done on that. I think that the British attitude towards Abu Hamza and to some of the other preachers like Sheikh Omar Bakri Muhammad is they would prefer to have them out in the street doing their preaching where they can basically keep an eye on them rather than driving them underground. Now, the American charges, to go back, it's a little odd because this kidnapping incident in Yemen took place in 1998. There were Americans who were kidnapped, but they weren't among the kidnapping victims who were killed in a shootout to free the 16 hostages that were held briefly. And trying to establish a terrorist training camp in Oregon that happened in 1999, so it's not quite clear why they decided to move against Abu Hamza now.
Well, we know that there is someone in jail in prison in Seattle who apparently used to run his website and is apparently turning on him and naming names. But the question to you in just the few seconds we have, Michael, is extradition now automatic?
Well, no, there's an inevitable judicial process, a couple of months, maybe even the early autumn before it's all heard. But when John Ashcroft said death penalty is the ultimate sanction he might face, he may have created some problems there because in a new extradition treaty between the U.S. and Britain signed last year, the British government does not have to extradite anyone if they face the death penalty because there's no death penalty here in Britain.
Oh, so it'll still to be discussed. Michael, thank you so much.
Thank you, Robin.
WBUR reporter Michael Goldfarb spoke to us from London. Up to 1,000 people from a single Haitian town are reported dead in floods and mudslides that are sweeping the Dominican Republic and Haiti on the island of Hispaniola. Search crews are working around the clock to recover bodies and assess the damage as relief organizations, including U.S. troops, are delivering food to both sides of the island. Sylvine Simon is the director of Radio Nouveauté, a Haitian radio news station in Boston. He joins us on the line. First of all, welcome.
Well, thank you very much, and I'm very pleased to be on your wave today.
Well, we're thrilled to have you. Can you tell us what you're hearing? How widespread is the damage?
And it's big, very big, because, you know, with the poverty of Haiti and, you know, the island, with the crisis, with the departure of the president of Haiti, and nothing is under control, really. With the flood, it's a natural disaster, but, you know, with more than 1,000 people passed away because of the condition of the island itself. You know, people, mm-hmm. the situation they are living now. They cut trees from everywhere to make charcoal, and you know, and the garden are not very well, you know, taken care of to support the water.
Right.
On the
We've been reading about this, that there are so many trees cut down. That's part of why there are mudslides. But people have been eating literally baked mud because there's so little vegetation there. How are you hearing from people in Haiti? How are you staying informed?
I am the owner of Radio Nouveauté, WRNM 1640 in Matapen.
That's right.
And I have news coming from Haiti every day because we have three correspondents coming for calling us from Haiti in the morning, in the afternoon at 12:30 today, and at night at 8 p.m.
Well, we know, and because of people like you and your reporters, that Haiti has been in turmoil since earlier this year. Jean-Bertrand Aristide leaving at the end of February. The poverty there is just overwhelming. What do people need there?
Over there, really, what is it is getting people back to the country? Because you have a lot of people, they leave the countryside to go and live in the city, like in Port-au-Prince and in the big city of Haiti. And they don't taking care of, really, of the lands. Mm-hmm. And this is the situation. Most of the lands, they are not, nobody work on them, really, to take care of, like the way they're supposed to put walks. A wood and to support the ground, to have to make some to bring the water from the river to make some lakes, artificial lake. They used to do that. They don't do that anymore. Then they are really in big poverty over there. This is what the people from Haiti want now is to have somebody who can. Really help them.
That in the meantime, they've been knocked off their feet again. So tell us, in the short term, has this kind of flooding, this extensive, 1,000 people dead in one village in Mapu, has this happened before to this extent, and how are the relief efforts going? What are you hearing?
This is the first time that happened because it was raining for the past 10 days.
10 days.
You know, every day and for 10 days, you know, with the storm water, the thunderstorm, and, you know, that the way it is.
And just like few, I said, just, Sylvie, just the few seconds we have, is the relief effort working?
Then, you know, Haiti is usually, you have a lot of mountains. Mm-hmm. You know that. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't take too long for the water coming from the mountain get down to the sea. That means when the water is coming down with a lot of rain like that, it takes everywhere because people, they build their house anywhere, you know? Mm-hmm. And most of the time, they don't build their house on the top of the mountain. They go where it's low, you know, where it's flat. And when the water is coming, that's the way the water go.
Yeah.
You see? And so, that's what happened.
It's a desperate time there. Sylvine, thank you so much, and thank you for keeping us in touch with Haiti.
Okay, thank you very much. Call me anytime.
I will. Sylvine Simon. He's the director of the Haitian news radio station Radio Nouveauté. He joined us from Boston. A common test used to detect prostate cancer is fueling a debate in the medical world over how doctors should read the test results and how aggressively they should treat the cancer. A new study published in today's New England Journal of Medicine shows about 15% of men who passed a prostate-specific antigen or PSA test actually had prostate cancer. Joining us on the line is Dr. H. Ballantyne Carter from Johns Hopkins School of Medicine and author of the editorial accompanying the study in the New England Journal of Medicine. Doctor, remind us briefly, how does this test work?
Well, PSA is a protein that's produced by the prostate. And in men who have prostate disease, It can be measured in the blood. The problem is that it won't distinguish between those men who have prostate cancer and those men who have a benign enlargement that's not cancer, or men who have inflammation or infections in the prostate.
Mm-hmm. So the thinking had been in the past that if you had a certain number, I believe it's a 4 on the test?
Correct.
4 or lower, you really weren't at risk?
Correct.
And this new study is showing what?
Well, it shows that we can detect a lot of prostate cancers in men with low PSA levels, but that shouldn't really be surprising because we know there are a lot of prostate cancers in men as they age, and 90% of men have PSAs less than 4. So mm-hmm. we know that if we do biopsies and try to find cancer, we'll find it in a lot of these men.
So sum up the results of the study. It feels to me as if the study is saying that the higher PSA numbers mean that there's a more of a risk, but it doesn't seem as if there's any number at which there is no risk.
Well, that's correct. And men who had PSAs less than 0.5, the percentage of men was quite low. But as you get above 0.5 in the 2 to 4 range, the proportion of men who have cancer is actually very similar to those who have PSAs 4 to 10.
So what do doctors do now? I mean, what this leads further to is at what number do you do a biopsy, which can be invasive?
Well, that's the question. And I think an alternative to biopsying all men who have PSAs above 2 or 2.5 is to measure the PSA, but not the knee-jerk reaction to do a biopsy on all of these men, but to follow the PSA over time and get a PSA history, if you will, and see if PSA changes, then that might be the person you would want to do a biopsy on.
So obviously people should call their own doctors, but what would you say to men who are waking up this morning thinking that they had no problems but now realizing maybe they had a PSA of 4? Should they run out and get a biopsy?
I would say don't hit the panic button. You're with a lot of other men, and so you're not alone. And I don't think there should be the knee-jerk reaction to do a biopsy, but rather look at your PSA history and see what's happened over the years if you have a PSA history, and if you don't, begin to accumulate one.
Further, are men who have, let's say, a small amount of prostate cancer, if that's such a thing, are they needlessly having their prostate removed to treat that cancer?
It's a very good question, and it's true for any screening technique, including mammography. So there are always going to be men who have detection of prostate cancer, and they have a cancer that would never have harmed them during their lifetime. And in that case, treatment is not going to extend their life. So this is a risk of screening. With prostate cancer, it's particularly relevant because this disease progresses very, very slowly. So for older men, especially the disease, small tumors may not cause harm during their lifetime.
Dr. Carter, it sounds like, as usual, people should just consult with their doctor.
Correct. I would agree with that.
Thank you so much.
You're very welcome.
Dr. H. Ballantyne Carter is with the Johns Hopkins School of Medicine in Baltimore. Just ahead, the voice of the radical settler from the West Bank, according to The New Yorker's Jeffrey Goldberg. And later, who will lead the new Iraq as June 30th approaches? There's more coming up here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. In the current issue of The New Yorker magazine, reporter Jeffrey Goldberg writes about the Israeli settler movement. More precisely, he focuses on what he calls the absurdist wing of the movement. Goldberg follows the settlers through their daily confrontations, their eager embrace of conflict with Arabs in an effort to, as they say, bring about the coming of the Messiah. His story appears in the current New Yorker magazine, and Gail Harris spoke with him yesterday.
This is a lengthy and complex article about a long-standing and complex problem. Were you able to walk away with any conclusions?
Yeah, lots of conclusions, all tentative and many contradictory. And that's the problem with this story, is that there are contradictions inside contradictions. One obvious conclusion I came to pretty early on in the process was that the settlement project, or the Jewish settlements in the Gaza Strip and the West Bank, are killing Israel in a kind of way. And I wrote this piece out of concern for Israel. I mean, we know what they do in terms of stymieing Palestinian national aspirations, but what's fascinating and almost tragic is how they're sapping Israel of its physical and moral strength.
Hmm. Let's talk for a moment about some of the people that you meet.
Sure.
In this article. Anat Cohen is
yes.
one of them, one of the leaders of the Hebron Jews, who
right.
said that if one of her children should take a bullet, well, that death would sanctify God's name.
Right. This is a very fascinating thing for me, because what you see on the Palestinian side, and I write about this, is a glorification of death, including and sometimes especially the deaths of children as part of the cause. It's grotesque. And what I began to see on the Jewish side of the equation, among the Jewish fundamentalists, if you will, is a similar sort of set of beliefs in which children are seen as players in this fundamentalist drama, and that children's deaths serve a purpose in a kind of way.
Hmm. And you tell this story through a series of vignettes, in part, taunting back and forth. There's another story about the Arab olive trees.
Yeah, this is incredibly disturbing. I wrote about one particular radical settlement in the north of the West Bank in Samaria, in which the settlers have gone out at night and attacked and burned and basically torn apart hundreds and hundreds of olive trees belonging to the Arabs of neighboring villages. And this is one of the things that's mind-boggling about this case, is that in Judaism it's considered a very grave sin to attack and destroy fruit-giving trees, even those, and it says this specifically, even those belonging to your enemy. So what you have is settlers going out and hacking down the trees that are not just trees, but they're the livelihood of hundreds and hundreds of people. And it's quite obviously it's repulsive. And the majority of Israelis, when they look at this, can't believe what they're seeing. And yet, for some reason, many reasons that we could talk about, the settlers get away with it.
Well, and Jeffrey, what do you think will happen one day if the Israeli government decides that, in fact, these settlers have to leave the settlements and the Israeli army goes in to remove them? What then?
Well, it's not going to be pretty, but it's not going to be a civil war, because in the sort of traditional sense, I think in a civil war, you need both sides to believe that they have a reasonable chance of achieving their goals. And here you have a situation where the vast majority, look, only 3% of the Israeli public lives in the West Bank, for starters. The majority of those settlers, it's thought at least, will leave if the government tells them to leave and compensates them for their houses. But what you will have, I really do believe this, is what you will have is you will have violence. You will have certain types of settlers, sort of the most apocalyptic-minded settlers, using violence against the Israeli army. And, of course, that would be a tremendously losing proposition for the settlers, because then the people of Israel will turn completely against them. But I see tremendous ruptures in society and tremendous sadness and anger on all sides. But it's going to happen. I do think that eventually it will happen.
And can you give us a sense of the sort of apocalyptic vision of some of these settlers, what they expect to be the resolution of some of these issues?
Basically, what the hardcore among the settlers, the hardcore believes, is that they are doing this for the benefit not only of the Jewish people, but of all mankind. And, of course, when you think that you are a personal instrument of God's salvation, you feel somewhat empowered to take steps that, to, let's say, someone who doesn't subscribe to fundamentalist to a fundamentalist worldview, seems insane. And so that's what you have operating here. People, they think that they're doing not only what God wants, but what the world needs.
Well, and certainly one of the feelings that emerges from this very long and complex article, which took you months to put together and to write, is there doesn't seem to be a lot of room for compromise here. I mean, there are very definite positions that are staked out, and at least the people you talk to don't seem inclined to budge.
Well, look, you don't negotiate with God. I mean, and that's their fundamental, for the pun, but that's their fundamental viewpoint, is that this is not something to be discussed at Camp David or in Geneva or at the United Nations. This is God's law, and just as Muslim fundamentalists don't budge on their core beliefs and Christian fundamentalists don't budge, these Jewish fundamentalists don't budge. And to get them to budge, you would need their religious leaders to undergo radical transformation, a reformation within that branch of Judaism, which of course is a minority branch, but it does seem to have this hold over Israel right now.
Thank you, Jeffrey.
Thank you.
Jeffrey Goldberg speaking with Gail Harris. Jeffrey's article appears in the current issue of the New Yorker magazine. Tomorrow on Here and Now, U.S. officials warn of the possibility of terrorist attacks because of upcoming events. One of those events is this weekend. We'll check on security at the dedication of the new World War II Memorial and speak with Mario Van Peebles. That's tomorrow. Stay with us. More ahead Here and Now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. U.S. forces in Iraq have announced a deal to end the armed standoff in the city of Najaf. U.S. troops will suspend offensive operations there once the militia of rebel cleric Muqtada al-Sadr hands control of the city over to Iraqi forces. The deal between the U.S. and al-Sadr was brokered by Iraqi politicians and Shiite leaders. It does not require Muqtada al-Sadr to disband his militia. It also leaves the status of an arrest warrant for al-Sadr to be resolved later by Shia religious and political leaders. Meanwhile, with just 35 days to go until the U.S.-led coalition hands sovereignty to an Iraqi government, U.S. and U.N. officials are still scrambling to shape that government. Among the most difficult tasks, choosing a prime minister, one who will take the job and one who will be acceptable to the United States and Iraqi factions. Anne Bernard of the Boston Globe joins us from Baghdad. Anne, what's going on as this government tries to take shape?
Well, there's an incredible amount of jockeying behind the scenes to make sure that certain ethnic or religious groups get a representative into the top few posts.
Remind us, how much power will this new prime minister have?
Well, the prime minister will be the most powerful person in the government. The question is, how much power is the government going to have? Because a lot of Iraqis are skeptical that this government will truly be sovereign. And clearly this is the subject of a lot of disagreement between the United States and its allies right now. The government is not going to have control over the U.S. forces on its soil, although U.S. military says, of course, we'll be consulting with the Iraqis.
Well, so tell us, who is actually choosing this interim government? I mean, on the face of it, it's U.N. envoy Lakhdar Brahimi, but how much is the U.S. influencing that?
Well, Brahimi came in because the idea of the U.S. or the U.S.-appointed governing council choosing the government was unpalatable to many Iraqis. The idea was that a United Nations representative would be seen as more objective. He is going to make recommendations, but I don't believe he's going to make recommendations until he knows he has consensus, which, of course, includes consensus from the CPA, the U.S. occupation authorities, and the Iraqi Governing Council, as well as lots of Iraqi factions that are not in the Governing Council but are powerful.
You mentioned the jockeying for position. There's the Shia, the Sunni, the Kurds in the north. Who is likely to be the prime minister? From what camp?
the sense is that the prime minister will be a Shiite just because they're the largest group and they were oppressed for years under Saddam Hussein. But the delegate task is to parcel out the other positions in a way that make all the groups feel represented.
How much do Iraqis trust UN envoy Ebrahimi and his ability to independently pick this government?
Well, my sense is that they trust him more than the United States authority or the governing council, which they see as made up of people that came from outside Iraq. And the phrase they frequently use is they rode in on the back of an American tank. But the United Nations also has some credibility problems here. And everyone knows that the United States officials, as well as Britain and the governing council, has a big say in Brahimi's decision. So, you know, I don't think it's surprising that what I heard from governing council members yesterday and today is that there are different factions. The British may have their candidates, the Americans theirs. Brahimi is being pulled from many different sides.
And thank you.
Thanks a lot.
Anne Bernard of the Boston Globe speaking to us from Baghdad. Before the war in Iraq, it wasn't just the Bush administration that was duped by Iraqi exile-turned-politician Ahmad Chalabi. This week, the New York Times admitted it was, too. In an editor's note in yesterday's newspaper, the Times said it found a number of instances of coverage that was not as rigorous as it should have been. Specifically, its coverage of claims about weapons of mass destruction based on information which largely came from Chalabi. One of the prominent critics of the Times on this issue joins us from a studio in Washington. Jack Schaefer is editor-at-large at Slate magazine. Jack, what did the Times do wrong?
I am a great proponent of the right of journalists to get the story wrong. If we go in and we look at any major story that's ever been, breaking story that's been covered by the press, from Watergate to Iran-Contra to 9/11, you find that in the early reporting, even in the middle of the heavy reporting, journalists, page one journalists for the New York Times and CBS will get the story wrong. The important thing is, once having gotten it wrong, and once you're alerted to the fact that you got the story wrong, the most important thing is to go back, re-report the story, and get it right. I think that that was the Times' biggest flaw.
Well, one of the writers who's at the center of all of this, Judith Miller, says that these kinds of questions and criticism are beating up the messenger.
I don't think that's fair at all. There are plenty of news organizations out there that weren't hoodwinked by the defectors. The Knight Ridder Washington Bureau is cited by Michael Massing in the New York Review of Books as being providing some of the best and most skeptical reporting about weapons of mass destruction before the war. So I think that Judith Miller's absolutely wrong.
Well, let's explain Judith Miller's role in this. She was embedded for a while with a unit in Iraq that was receiving information with Chalabi, from Chalabi and the many supposed defectors and informants that he brought to the administration. What could she have done differently, in your view?
I think that she could apply the skepticism to the reports that she was getting from the defector that other journalists did. These defectors had been labeled as not credible by the CIA and the Defense Intelligence Agency.
Well, how does, it reminds us again of how it works. Reporters don't work completely independently. Is this an editor failure as well? Who were the sources?
Absolutely. Editors are supposed to act as cops or crossing guards and really make the reporter prove his story before it gets published. So as critical as I've been of Judith Miller, I can double all that criticism about the way that the New York Times handled this. You also have to remember that today's New York Times is very different from the New York Times that Judith Miller wrote all these stories for. Practically all the top editorial management has been replaced. So I'm very optimistic about the future of the New York Times with this new crew.
Some of the articles that the Times note from the editor points out, we remember there was the one about the Iraqi defector who described the secret Iraqi camp where Islamic terrorists were trained, the other about a defector who pointed out sites where there were apparently weapons of mass destruction, secret facilities for biological, chemical, and nuclear weapons. There were the infamous tubes. We remember these stories. Are you saying that at the time when they were written, there were people who would as vehemently prove that they didn't exist and they should have been included in the articles? Is it that simple?
I don't think it's that simple. I'm suggesting, and not facetiously, that newspapers and broadcasters should start a new department called Previously Thought to Be True. And they could come back and review a story like the aluminum tube story or any one of the defector story and say new evidence shows that, you know, the New York Times was wrong on April 21st. Mm-hmm. You know, saying I'm sorry is really not much good unless the newspaper backs it up with more accurate news.
Jack Schaefer, thank you.
You're welcome.
Jack Schaefer, editor-at-large at Slate Magazine. Still to come, Al Gore gives President Bush a barn-burning tongue-lashing. Republicans ask, where was Gore on terrorism during the Clinton administration? And the obsessive nature of art. You're listening to Here and Now. It's time to open up the Here and Now mailbag and air some of your thoughts. In our talk about global security with Terrence Taylor, the U.S. director of a British think tank, Mr. Taylor said that al-Qaeda terrorists might lose favor with followers if they undertake gruesome attacks, much as the IRA lost favor after the bombing in the Northern Ireland town of Omagh, which killed so many schoolchildren. This prompted Don Spence of Sinking Spring, Pennsylvania, to write, "You didn't make a distinction between the IRA and the real IRA, a splinter group which claimed responsibility for the bombing. The Brits, and Mr. Taylor did sound British, are pretty good at blurring the distinction in most of the interviews I've heard." Well, we received a lot of response after our conversation with Anthony Cordesman of the Center for Strategic and International Studies. We played an excerpt of his Senate testimony condemning neoconservatives who led the U.S. to war in Iraq. Nicholas Bodley of Waltham, Massachusetts, called.
I think probably the most important segment you broadcast this whole year so far was the, replay of Anthony Cordesman's comments and also your interview with him. It's absolutely right on the money, and he has some things of rare importance to say. Boy, you have really distinguished yourself in the best way by running that segment.
Well, Francis Sack of Coatesville, Pennsylvania, was disappointed with our conversation with reporter Warren Levinson concerning the 9/11 hearings in New York City. She writes, Levinson said that what stood out the most were the disturbances by the 9/11 family members. This was the most interesting part of the story, but it wasn't pursued. Indeed, we need to know what questions the commission is not asking, and the families have a right to answers. Our segment on the new production of Tennessee Williams' very first play, which he put in a drawer after receiving a less than positive response from fellow students at his college playwriting seminar at the University of Iowa, brought a note from Stephen Wilder of Philadelphia, who attended the same school years later when rumors of Williams were legend.
Yes, I was there in the 1970s, and I had actually heard a version of it from my mother, who was there in the 1940s and early 50s, that Tennessee Williams had flunked out of Iowa because he had handwritten rather than typed his senior thesis, and it was supposed to have been The Glass Menagerie.
Well, the legend was born of what we now know is the true story, right? That he did graduate, but his fellow students hated his first play. It wasn't The Glass Menagerie. It was Spring Storm. But, Steve, I understand from your email to us that the college newspaper would try to debunk that rumor, but they weren't successful.
Right. I had read once in the Daily Iowa, the college newspaper, an attempt to debunk that rumor along with several others. And those things never work.
Right.
I think that was more to just as a protest against the way the university worked, that rumor had lived for so long.
Right. And in fact, it wasn't the university that rejected him, really. It was his fellow students.
Correct. Yeah. That is correct. Even his professor seems to have thought it was a great work, but a nude, as he called it.
A nude, right. Needed dressing up.
Right.
Steve, thank you.
Thank you.
And finally, Jason Thomas of Charlotte, North Carolina, wanted to know, what was that piece of classical music we played following our story on a new documentary about gay marriage? Jason, you haven't been to a wedding lately. Johann Pachelbel's Canon in D Major is almost a prerequisite. As always, we love to hear your thoughts. Our email address is letters@here-now.org. That's letters@here-now.org. Or you can give us a call and leave a message at 617-358-0397. Please remember to include your full name, phone number, and town. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. With this quick picture from the national political scene, former Vice President and former Democratic presidential candidate Al Gore lashed out at the Bush administration yesterday in a fiery speech before 900 members of the liberal activist group MoveOn.org at New York University. Gore said that President Bush has built a reputation as the most dishonest president since Richard Nixon. Citing failures in Iraq, Gore called for the resignation of several top Bush deputies.
We simply cannot afford to further increase the risk to our country with more blunders by this team. Donald Rumsfeld ought to resign immediately as the chief architect of this plan. Paul Wolfowitz, Douglas Feith, the intelligence chief Stephen Cambone, all ought to resign immediately. Our nation is at risk every single day Rumsfeld remains as Secretary of Defense. We need someone with good judgment and common sense. Condoleezza Rice ought to resign immediately. She has badly mishandled the coordination of national security policy. This is a disaster for our country. And they are responsible, along with the president and vice president. We may have to wait to get rid of Bush and Cheney, but we ought to call on our Republican friends to join us in getting the rest of that team out right now.
Former Vice President Al Gore speaking at New York University yesterday. Well, conservative groups were quick to fire back at Gore by pointing to Clinton administration failures. Republican National Committee spokesman Jim Dyke said during the eight Clinton-Gore years, Osama bin Laden declared war on the United States five times and terrorists killed U.S. citizens on at least four occasions. He added that Gore either does not understand the threat of global terror or he has amnesia. A fire in a London warehouse this week destroyed millions of dollars of art from gallery owner Charles Saatchi's enormous collection. Many of the pieces were some of the most important examples of work from the young British artist movement. Well, art from young American artists was at the center of a recent exhibit in Boston titled OCD, short for Obsessive Compulsive Disorder. The exhibit was organized by visual artist Matthew Nash, who, after recognizing obsessive tendencies in his own work, sought out other artists preoccupied with a certain theme or creative method. Here now is Andrea Shea, toured the exhibit recently, where she spoke with Nash about the art of obsessive behavior.
There are eight artists in the show, including myself, and everybody was given ample space and opportunity to pursue one line of obsession. And it's either an activity that they do repeatedly, that over time, just by sheer repetition, becomes obsessive, or an idea that gets enacted out in an extreme way. But each person was given encouragement to be as obsessive as they wanted. The artist Jennifer Schmidt has made designs and patterns by filling in the bubbles of Scantron sheets. The artist Morgan Phelan makes these beautiful cut paper pieces of cascading knives and scissors and sharp instruments that sort of feel like fun versions of your worst nightmare. The artist Jason Dean, when we were talking about obsession, he mentioned, first off, bubble wrap. And so he turned his fixation with popping every single bubble in a roll of bubble wrap into sort of pseudo-scientific experiments. Joe Trupia, he's obsessed with the 40-hour work week. Everything he does takes exactly 40 hours. Luke Walker photographs people from behind while they're walking down the street.
We all look to a certain degree, and I just started taking the photos, you know. I just was walking down the street one day in New York City and had my camera, and I just started shooting. After, you know, doing this for a while, I started being quite amazed at how many pictures, you know, started piling up. And I think that's really what's so amazing. You know, the photos are a document of how often I look. It's an obsession of mine, but I don't think I'm the only one.
And Nancy Havlick produces these beautiful sugar eggs. I'm looking at them right now. They're made out of sugar, and they're decorated with cake icing, and then she lays them out in patterns of rugs so that you kind of get these. It's a rug you can't walk on, but you kind of want to eat, and they're just beautiful and decorative.
You know, with any obsession, you really, I don't think you know you have one until someone calls you on it. And I've been making sugar eggs for about 10 years or so, I'm coming up on, and I just started one day. I said, I'm going to teach myself to make a sugar egg. I thought I'd put some stuff in it, and then one led to another and another, and I don't think I've ever stopped or taken a break in the whole 10 years. And I've thrown a million sugar eggs away, and I've given a ton away, and yeah, there are many dumpsters filled with many sugar eggs at this point. So,
and how many eggs again are here?
I think it's 3,000. Some are in half eggs and some are whole eggs. So it comes out at probably about 2,500 to 3,000.
So Matt, now we're standing in front of your piece. Can you explain it? I know it involves thousands. Is it thousands of Reese's Pieces?
Thousands. It's actually M&M's and Reese's Pieces. I lucked out. M&M's ran that campaign where they took all the color out of their M&M's, and so they had all black and all white ones for a while, which made my life a lot easier. What I did here is I laid the candies out in a grid. They're 50 by 50, and I wasn't too particular about having the M's up or down. They're four colors, white, black, yellow, and orange, and they sort of become the tones of a photograph. And when you step back from them, they sort of resolve into a larger image. There are images sort of taken from a whole collection of photos, wounded soldiers on the beach, a close-up of an injured man, General Eisenhower. But when you get up close to them, they fall apart. It's just candy. It's not until you're 8 or 10 feet away that they make sense.
So is your obsession with the candies, or is it with the pixels?
I would say my obsession is in the act of making them. Sitting in front of a table and moving the candies around and knowing that no one M&M meant that much, but when they were all finally put together, there was going to be an image to see. And there are a lot of ways of making pictures, there are a lot of ways of making photographs, but to spend 4 or 5 hours laying things out for the 2 or 3 minutes it took to snap the shutter, that for me was the obsessive part.
So do you expect there'll be any controversy or objection to the title you've decided to give this exhibit, OCD?
I hope not. I should also point out that I didn't ask for anybody's medical records when I put the show together, so I can't say either way whether or not anybody in the show is clinically obsessive-compulsive or not. Looking around, I can see in the work certain tendencies that may be undiagnosed. I don't know. I'm not a doctor. But this show was put together with a sense of humor. It's meant to be lighthearted. The work is all very focused, but I don't think much of it is very serious. I think everybody here went out of their way to make sure that their obsession and their fixation also came with a dose of fun. And that's the theme of the show, letting your one mania have its day.
Here now, producer Andrea Shea speaking with Matthew Nash, creator of the recent exhibit OCD. To view the works there, go to our website, here-now.org. Here Now is a production of WBUR Boston. Our production team includes Andrea Shea, Lynn Menegon, April Peavy, Alan Cockle, Karen Millimetz, and Lindsay Crudell, Emiko Tamagawa, and Stefano Katsonis. Our managing editor is Kathleen McKenna. Vince Fairchild is our engineer. He's assisted by Ian Hughes. Our web producer is Zach Christo, and our intern is Nick Weiss Richmond. The senior producer of Here Now is Mark Navin. I'm Robin Young. Get into your radio and join us again, Here and Now. Thank you. For a cassette or CD of Here and Now, go to our website, here-now.org, or call 1-800-909-9287. Cassettes or CDs are $15 each, which includes shipping and handling.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.